Rebel groups in Syria have pulled off a stunning victory, bringing down a brutal, longtime dictator.
This is the reality. I've been telling myself that it's never going to happen.
I'm Carol Hills. We'll hear about what Syria's new reality feels like from the capital, Damascus, and what it all means for the Russians, who just lost an important Middle East ally.
The way that they've spun it is actually very interesting, is how they basically blamed Assad for everything.
Also in South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol survived an impeachment vote, but there will be more.
The opposition party says it's going to be filing bills to impeach Yoon until they succeed.
And kids from Afghanistan living as refugees here in this country find real joy in the game of cricket.
Having the sport that they played at home that feels like home to them gives them that sense of belonging here.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us. Syrians are starting to come to terms with the monumental shift taking place in their country. Many are euphoric after rebel groups led by an Islamist militia called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham brought down Syria's longtime dictator, Bashar al-Assad. HTS, as the group is known, is only beginning to establish its control. But Assad is gone. He's been given refuge in Russia. Along with his father Hafez before him, the Assad regime maintained a brutal authoritarian grip over Syria for more than 50 years. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, Syrians are celebrating, but they're also nervous about what happens next.
A mother's ululation as she embraces her son for the first time in years. The sound she's making is a sign of celebration. My life, she tells him as she showers him with kisses. All these years, may God bless you and keep you. The man is young, tall, with a beard. His mother is sitting cross-legged on the floor. A blanket covers her legs. It appears that the two haven't seen each other for years. In another video, three brothers hug and wail, then collapse onto the street. One of them traces his wrinkled hands on the face of another, as if to make sure he's really there in person. The caption reads, "They haven't seen each other for 7 years." Scenes similar to these are playing out in parts of Syria. The war separated and displaced millions of families. Some of what's emerging from there is harrowing. Witnesses have filmed prisoners being set free in several cities. They look pale, dazed, and emaciated. In this video posted online, one of them asks in bewilderment, "What's happening?" Someone tells him that the government has fallen. The man exclaims in joy, then continues his run with a huge smile on his face. Over the years, human rights groups documented mass hangings at the Sednaya prison near Damascus, giving it the nickname Human Slaughterhouse.
Hundreds of people coming, trying to reach the prison. They asking about their relatives.
Dr. Mahmoud Mustafa rushed to the prison as soon as the government fell. He shared some videos with me. He says families are gathering in search of their loved ones. Mustafa says the prisoners need medical care.
They will have many diseases related to this, malnutrition, many skin diseases.
As an ophthalmologist, he says he's going to be advising the prisoners who've been in the darkness for a long time not to suddenly walk out into daylight. They can damage their eyes. He tells me that there are still many prisoners trapped in underground cells. The prison is like a labyrinth, he says, and the doors can't be opened. The guards have left. Further in the north of the country, I reached Abdul Kafi Alhamdo, an English teacher. We've been in touch since he had to flee his home in Aleppo 8 years ago.
I'm just thrilled with happiness I cannot express by words. What a day!
Alhamdo had to leave after Assad forces closed in on his city and the Russian airstrikes intensified. He tells me when the rebel forces retook Aleppo about a week ago, he dropped everything and drove there immediately.
I went there to visit my friends who died before I leave Aleppo. I went to their graves to like this. I told them that we're back. Justice is achieved.
Justice achieved, he says. But the retaking of the cities by the rebels in Syria didn't happen without clashes. over a scratchy phone line. Aham Al-Hussein, a 24-year-old dentistry student in the city of Hama, tells me he saw a lot of fighting. He says an airstrike hit the home of his girlfriend, killing her and her entire family, 10 people in total. Al-Hussein says he tried to take her to the hospital, but it was too late. She died in front of me, he says. It's hard to find a Syrian who hasn't been touched by the war. Half of the population was displaced. In 2014, the United Nations stopped counting the dead. So many were dying so fast, it was hard to keep up. Now, after enduring more than a decade of loss, displacement, and atrocities, Syrians are trying to make sense of what comes next.
I've been crying for about a week now.
Sara Hunaydi was forced to leave Syria for her activism when she was 17 years old.
I was a very passionate young feminist.
She says she used her real name to write posts on Facebook in support of the uprisings.
My friends were taken into custody and tortured, and my ex was tortured for a month.
Then she started to get threats, and she knew she had to leave. Hunaydi moved to the U.S. 6 years ago, and she's been working with the families of those who disappeared in Assad's prisons to document their cases. For a long time, she says, she felt that Assad was going to remain in power with impunity.
This is the reality. I've been telling myself that it's never going to happen.
Hunaydi belongs to the Druze minority in Syria, and she says she's excited about this moment, but is watching the rise of the group Hayat-e Tahrir al-Sham with apprehension. She says she hopes the new Syria is a place for all Syrians. As for what she's going to do next...
I miss home so much. I haven't met my brother's kids. They only know me through a screen. I will go back immediately.
So many Syrians are planning to do the same. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafori.
For more than half a century, the Assad family ruled Syria with an iron fist. Hafez al-Assad was in power from the early 1970s until his death in 2000. His son Bashar then took over and managed to survive years of civil war in Syria. That war has killed hundreds of thousands of people and driven millions to flee abroad. But even for people who were not persecuted by the regime, life under Assad was hard. We reached historian Sami Mubaid in Syria's capital, Damascus, to hear why Assad was so widely detested.
Damascus is very happy. Since it was the capital, Damascus suffered from the most harshest grip and the highest form of corruption during the Assad years. And because of that iron grip, Damascus was never vocally anti-regime because the regime was everywhere. And so this is the first time that Damascus actually speaks out in 40 years. This is the first time Damascenes are able to say, we've had enough, and we welcome the change of regime.
How did you hear about it yourself, and how did you react? I mean, were you in disbelief?
We were up all night, and everyone I knew was up all night. We were following the news minute by minute. You know, Damascus fell before the rebel movement arrived. By the time Assad had left and the army had collapsed, the rebels were not there. So there was these couple of hours where there was some chaos in some streets. There was some looting. There was some theft. But the minute HTS, again, which is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, started entering the city, things started to return under control. By daybreak, people were still afraid. People were still home. Nobody was going out. And today, life began returning to normal. 24 hours into the liberation, pharmacies have reopened, grocery stores, supermarkets. You can see streets filled with passerbys and cars. We're hearing that electricity is going to be restored fully within a month. Schools should be open within a week, and life goes back to normal.
We've seen a lot of videos of Syrians celebrating the end of the Assad regime. Why was this government so hated by people in Syria?
Corruption at every level, lack of freedoms to say anything or do anything, very high degree of nepotism, and failure. You had corruption with a collapsing state. Nothing was working properly. The police was corrupted. The judiciary was corrupted. The school system was corrupted. I think if we put all of that together, we can understand why the regime was so hated. Plus, what was really evident this time is that even Assad's own power base had abandoned him. This time, it was people who had fought for him first time. They had said, we're fed up with him. We don't want to fight anymore. Look at what they're saying now. And it's not just because of the change of leadership. There are many times when a government falls or a regime falls, and people who supported the regime hold on to their policies. Now, even those who were very hardcore are saying that he abandoned us. He was a coward. And many are saying, if he was going to step down that swiftly, why did he send all our young men into the battles and lead to the killing of so many Syrians?
You mentioned corruption and a failure to run the country, but you also said today Syrians can speak without fear for the first time. What did both Assads do that caused so much fear?
First of all, those who did speak their mind were hauled off and arrested, and many spent long years in detention. And those who worked in public life, and this is very important, learned how to apply self-censorship, because they saw what had happened to others and they began fearing for their own lives or their children or their property, and they would just not want to go down that path anymore. Many people were saying, I don't want to go to jail, so if I want to live in this country, I need to keep my mouth shut, otherwise I'm going to suffer. And those who did not want to go down that line paid a very high price.
Sami, how have you managed? You live in Damascus. How have you managed under this regime?
I shut my mouth up. I'm a political scientist by training and by education, and I worked as a historian for the past 24 years so that I would not venture into politics, so that I would not be under scrutiny.
Why did the Assad regime resort to things like barrel bombs, chemical weapons, imprisonment, and torture at the height of the uprising?
Barrel bombs cost nothing. They're much less expensive than heavy weapons. They went for the cheapest and most destructive of methods at minimal cost.
Sami, the rebels from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, they appear to be in control of the majority of the country now. What are you hoping for in the coming weeks? I mean, this is a huge kind of watershed moment, huge sense of relief by Syrians. But what are you going to be looking for?
For starters, I'm expecting better services, electricity, gas, fuel, the availability of products. And now that, and something that's very important here, once HTS sets up a viable government that is free from corruption, we can send our kids back to school, we can return to a life with a lot of decency and normalcy. I'm expecting a much brighter future for Syria. You know, the Syrian Republic is young, and we tested with democracy for a few years until we were rocked by military coups starting 1949. And since then, this has just been one coup after another, 9 of which succeeded, 11 of which failed. So that didn't give a chance for Syrian democracy to flourish. And I think now is that golden opportunity. And I'm glad to be alive to see it. I would never have dreamt of watching the Ba'ath collapse and watching Assad, not even in my wildest dreams.
I know this is a real moment of euphoria, but I have to ask this. I mean, we have watched how other countries like Libya, Egypt, Iraq have had turmoil and violence after ousting a dictator. As an historian, what lessons could you apply to help Syria find a good path forward?
What Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is doing now and has been doing and will be doing, they have been confiscating arms. So pretty soon you're going to find no arms left in the country. If you're able to monopolize arms, and if no arms enter from abroad, and none are likely to, I think we're going to have a safe transition.
Sami Mubayad is a Syrian historian. He spoke to us from the capital, Damascus. We've mentioned that a coalition of rebel groups pushed Assad out of power, the most prominent among them, the group HTS, and its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani. Learn more about the coalition and about al-Julani specifically online at theworld.org. Our recent reporting has dug into his ideology and how the different rebel groups see the future of Syria. That's at theworld.org.
Hi there, Carolyn Beeler here. I wanted to take a minute to thank everyone who has donated to The World's Fall fundraiser so far. Your support means so much to us. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, we do still need you, especially because if we can raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched dollar for dollar thanks to a generous donor. So if you give $100, The World gets $200. Your gift will go twice as far, making a big difference in the stories we can bring you in 2025. So if you haven't already, please join our community of supporters all over the globe by making a donation at theworld.org/give. That is theworld.org/give, or visit the link in our episode notes. Thank you again so much.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. In South Korea, the effort to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol failed over the weekend. The motion to remove Yoon was called after he unexpectedly declared martial law last week, sending waves of panic across South Korea. The opposition was united to impeach him, but Yoon's own party stood behind him. But South Korea is still facing political uncertainty, with many calling for the president to resign. Reporter Rebecca Rossman is in Seoul and explains what happened on Saturday.
So the opposition, which needed 200 of 300 votes to move forward with the impeachment, ended up being 5 votes short. That's because the president's party decided to boycott Saturday's vote. And today, investigators said they were imposing a travel ban on Yoon while they investigate his botched attempt to impose martial law.
Now, the opposition has called the actions of the president's party a, quote, second coup. What does that mean?
Well, they think after everything that's happened over the last week, Yoon needs to go. But South Korea's constitution states that a president can only be replaced if he resigns or is impeached. So they see his party's refusal to take part in Saturday's impeachment vote as a means to let Yoon cling on to power.
Now, President Yoon, he survived this impeachment vote, but it seems that his political survival is very much in doubt. How worried do you think he is about that?
Oh, I think pretty worried. The opposition party says it's going to be filing bills to impeach Yoon until they succeed, with the next vote expected to be as early as this coming Saturday. And on top of that, Yoon is not a popular figure right now amongst voters. He only has a 17% approval rating, and 70% of people here think he should be impeached.
I understand you went to the National Assembly over the weekend. What did you see?
Yeah, I went just a couple of hours before Saturday's vote, and already there were thousands of people gathered in what was really a festive atmosphere. So this is the sound of people chanting for Yoon to be impeached. And one thing that struck me is that you really had people of all ages showing up, even parents who had brought their young children with them to protest. I spoke with one young woman, a 24-year-old student named Haiwan Moon, who was sitting in front of the parliament gate with an electric blanket and snacks, looking kind of tired.
I just been here all night long.
She said she had come up by bus all the way from the south of the country and had already been camped out for around 14 hours when we spoke. And mind you, this was amidst below freezing temperatures. Moon told me she isn't much of a political person, but after seeing President Yoon declare martial law last week, she felt like she had to come and make a statement.
I don't think he's a proper president, so I'm trying to staying here to show people that he is not a good president.
And that sentiment is widespread, and the protests only seem to be getting stronger here. Saturday night alone attracted around 100,000 people, according to police estimates.
So what's the impact of this on the relationship between the U.S. and South Korea?
So Yoon has been seen as a strong ally of the U.S. He's been seen as a driving force in a three-way partnership between Japan, South Korea, and the U.S., and a pro-democracy force in the region, able to work with the U.S. in the face of North Korea's growing nuclear threat. But the Biden administration seems to have been caught by surprise by this week's events.
Rebecca, what's next in this political drama?
Well, the opposition says they will continue submitting impeachment bills until one of them passes, so we can expect a lot more political turmoil in the days and weeks to come. There's also the ongoing investigations looking into whether or not Yoon's declaration amounted to leading an insurrection. If he's found guilty of this, he could be arrested. So all this to say, the country is facing a lot of uncertainty that has left many feeling frustrated and angry.
Reporter Rebecca Rossman in the South Korean capital, Seoul. When you're in middle school in a place that's more than 7,000 miles away from where you spent most of your childhood, there's nothing like a game from home to make you feel happy. Colorado Public Radio's education reporter, Jenny Brundine, recently spent time with students from Afghanistan who just love being able to play on their school's cricket team.
Tuesday is the best day of the week, says sixth grader Mudassar.
Because it's different when I finish with school, then I come here to play cricket. And work hard to go to the games and win the games.
It's the day of the week that about 15 boys, all originally from Afghanistan, are giddy with joy. They're playing the most popular sport in their home country and the second most popular sport in the world, cricket. Tuesday is the club's practice day.
Everybody yell out your favorite position.
Batting! 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 Batting!
The first thing I learn about cricket is the main positions. Batting, bowling, or pitching the ball, and fielding, like outfield. Though it seems none of these boys much likes that one. Except the captain, 8th grader Mudassar.
The game of cricket, everything is my favorite. Batting, bowling, fielding, everything. I just love this game. Cricket makes me feel proud and happy in this school.
Many of these boys came to the U.S. within the past 4 years after the Taliban came to power in 2021. Mohammed Idris.
I was so sad because nobody was talking Pashto or Persian, and I can't speak English.
The boys have different levels of English, but Idris says being here makes him happy.
Friends is there, yeah.
Your friends are there.
Yeah.
Charlene Falls is an English development teacher and sponsor of the club. When she heard the boys were playing on Sundays in a community park, she scrounged old cricket equipment. Then she learned about the Denver Youth Cricket Academy. It now provides coaches. In 2022, a cricket club was born.
Having the sport that they played at home, that feels like home to them, gives them that sense of belonging here and something to look forward to at the end of their school day and a chance for them to make friends.
So the captain's going to go get his, what is it called, a bat?
The boys are super patient explaining the game to me.
Hey, tell me, why did it count for two?
Because they both ran two times.
They both ran two times. They hit that.
Two players are up at once, running between wickets at opposite ends of the pitch.
The corner, that's going to count six. And it's going on the floor, that's going to count four on one.
Passions run high. The boys speak in Pashto or Dari. But sometimes English slips in.
I moved, brother, I jumped.
But I still hit your leg, huh? That doesn't mean you move.
Some rules are too complicated for my first game, like the many ways you can be out, like if the wicketkeeper knocks a bail from a stump before the batter returns after hitting the ball. Middle school boys are middle school boys, no matter where you're born. It's 37 degrees out right now. Where is your coat?
My coat is in a home anyway, because when I come in the bus, it was warm.
But that doesn't matter. As the light fades and his friends run around, 6th grader Mohammed Idris tells me the club has helped shift his view of school.
School is like home.
School is like home.
Like your teacher is like your mom, like the principal is like your dad. Friends, everybody is like your sister, brother.
Everyone in the school is like your family, he says. The boys close out the practice and now must wait for the first Tuesday in March after the snow melts. For The World, I'm Jenny Brendine, Denver.
Nicaragua's authoritarian president, Daniel Ortega, is accused of widespread human rights violations. Thousands of Nicaraguans have fled, but they're not giving up on their home country.
We are still fighting. We stand tall and we carry on.
We'll hear from a singer who's using her music to push for change in Nicaragua. That's ahead on today's edition of The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The West African nation of Ghana has joined a global trend. Voters there just ousted an incumbent party, choosing instead to go with political change. Supporters of the president-elect John Dramani Mahama took to the streets Sunday, blaring horns and waving flags in celebration. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman is in Ghana's capital, Accra. Ridwan, what were the key issues on voters' minds when they went to the polls this weekend?
Carol, the main issue has been about the economy. Many Ghanaians are grappling with high living costs. Youth unemployment was also top of mind for a lot of people, especially importers, especially traders. They feel that the lack of stability for the currency was a major issue.
The person they elected, it's a change, but it's also somebody they know from before, John Dramani Mahama. I mean, he's been president before. So why did they choose him?
So there are so many reasons. One of them is the economy, because this NPP government came on the back of making the economy better, creating jobs, fighting corruption. And if you consider the figures, you realize that they have performed abysmally. They give the country a lot of hope. And when you speak to people on the streets of Accra, in Kumasi and other parts of the country, people are disappointed. They expected a lot more from the ruling government.
West Africa has seen 6 military coups in the last 3 years. I understand many Ghanaians were kind of holding their breath, hoping for a smooth electoral process. How did elections go?
Well, all the observer missions that came to Ghana, both domestic and, you know, international observer missions, have given the country a pass. But it wasn't entirely smooth. We recorded, you know, pockets of violence, and also tragically, we lost at least 6 people due to the violence. There were also reports of attempted ballot stuffing and also disruptions caused by supporters who were trying to supposedly police the ballot and ended up creating a lot of chaos. And so some of the results delayed, and it created a whole lot of tension. And you realize that for the first time, we had the other contender conceding earlier, even before the Electoral Commission announced the results, which is what eased the tension. Because if he hadn't done that, then the whole country will be in anticipation of the results, and the commission is delaying because of these challenges. But because he announced it earlier, that eased the tension a bit.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. We have a clip of Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia conceding defeat, saying that his party would not be a disruptive opposition.
The people of Ghana have spoken. The people have voted for change, and we respect that decision with all humility.
Ridwan, voter turnout, though, was low. Why do you think that was?
The turnout was 60.9%, which is very low, because previous elections we had around 70 and 60. And what we are learning from analysts is that the low turnout reflects growing despondency among the electorate. Like, many are disillusioned with both major political parties, especially in the ruling party strongholds. Turnout was shockingly low because these are areas that have continuously voted for the ruling party, and they felt that they hadn't done enough. And also the fact that a lot of people have lost trust, not just with the ruling party, but also even the opposition party, because, I mean, the opposition party has been in power before, and they have seen, you know, they have a lot of similarities in terms of addressing what exactly the issues are for the people. And a lot of the time, they have fallen short in doing that.
One interesting result of this election is that Ghana is getting its first female vice president. What can you tell us about Jane Nana Opoku-Agyeman?
You know, she's had a lot of firsts. She was the first female vice chancellor for a public university in Ghana, which is the Cape Coast University. She's also a former minister of education. And so she brings a lot. You know, we've seen very few women in politics. And so a lot of analysts believe that she is going to inspire a lot of women to get into politics. And it's also marks a significant milestone for women's representation in Ghanaian politics. And of course, she has also been celebrated as a step forward for gender inclusivity.
Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Ghana's capital, Accra. Returning now to the stunning turn of events in Syria, the deposed dictator Bashar al-Assad is now in exile in Russia. A spokesman at the Kremlin today said it was Vladimir Putin who made the decision to welcome Assad and his family. For years, Russia's political and military support for Assad enabled him to cling to power, and it gave the Kremlin a foothold in the heart of the Middle East. As The World's Daniel Offman reports, that Russian foothold is now in jeopardy.
In September of 2015, more than 4 years after the start of the Syrian civil war, Russian President Vladimir Putin made an announcement. He said, "We support the Syrian government in its fight against terrorist aggression, and we will continue to provide Syria with military support." Just days later, Russia took a drastic step. Here's Nikolai Kazhanov, an associate professor at the Gulf Studies Center at Qatar University.
For the first time since the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, Moscow was deploying its military forces in the Middle East and, moreover, deploying in the country that was waging a war.
Kazhanov explains that Moscow was compelled to back Assad because he was one of the few overtly pro-Russian leaders in the region. President Putin was concerned that the regime changes in the region resulting from the Arab Spring would turn countries against Russia and towards the West. It established a long-term military presence in Syria by setting up bases throughout the country and taking control of airfields. It gained naval access to the Mediterranean. With Russian boots on the ground, Kazhanov says Putin was sending a message to the United States and other Western countries.
By making this unprecedented move, it wanted to show that whether they like it or not, they have to talk to Moscow.
This was about prestige, a show of strength. But to establish that military strength, Russia needed to keep Assad in power. Here's how Putin defined Russia's role in Syria back in 2015.
Наши действия будут осуществляться в строго заданных рамках.
Putin said three things. Russia will only fight against terrorist groups. Second, Russia will exclusively provide aerial military support and won't participate in ground operations. And third, Russia's military support will have an expiration date.
Russia tried to hide this interference. They tried to show this intervention like a bloodless intervention for Russian forces. Of course, it was a lie.
This is Gleb Irisov, a former officer in the Russian Air Force who also served in Syria.
From the very beginning, Russia was involved not just in the air combat, but also on the ground. It was just conducted secretly from the people using their paramilitary units like Wagner Group.
The Wagner Group is the notorious private military company formed by Yevgeny Prigozhin. Russia's military intervention in Syria was a turning point for Wagner, which began operating across the Middle East and Africa.
ЧВК Wagner проводит РПД, делает Россию еще более великой.
In this video, Prigozhin is boasting that Wagner is making Russia great on all continents. He goes on to say that they're fighting terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda all over the world. Nikolai Kazhanov says that Wagner was a convenient tool for Moscow to use in what he calls the gray zones of warfare.
Where Moscow didn't want to deploy their official boots on the ground, but could use the services of Wagner in order to pursue its goals. And if there was a failure, it could always deny their connection with Russian military.
That deniability was crucial because with Russia's military presence in Syria, reports of atrocities and war crimes were well documented. Russian airstrikes killed thousands of Syrian civilians. In a 2022 report, Human Rights Watch determined that the Syrian-Russian military alliance has conducted indiscriminate aerial bombing of schools, hospitals, and markets. But from the Kremlin's perspective, human rights were secondary. Propping up Assad was seen as highly beneficial for Moscow.
Russia got a testing ground where it was showing, advertising, testing its military equipment. After 2015, the sales of Russian weapons substantially increased. Meanwhile, as I said, the Russian military was getting an expertise of fighting the war overseas.
Kazhanov says things changed in 2022, leading up to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. That's when Russia reduced its military presence, transferring resources from Syria to Ukraine. In recent weeks, Syrian opposition forces began gaining ground, and Russia was either unwilling or unable to push back.
They are just insufficient to do any miracles in order to support Assad. So they're basically like a small grain of sand in a huge storm.
The way that they've spun it is actually very interesting, is how they basically blamed Assad for everything.
This is Nicole Graevsky, a fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace think tank. She says when opposition troops were advancing, the Kremlin's narrative was that they had done everything they could and that this was fully Assad's failure.
I was somewhat surprised that the Russians offered him asylum. I mean, the Russians have not necessarily liked Assad throughout this whole intervention, throughout this whole campaign, but they realized he was kind of the force in town, the kind of stable leader that they could back.
The biggest unknown for Moscow now is whether it will be able to maintain its military presence in Syria. According to Russian state media, the Kremlin has been in touch with opposition forces who say they will guarantee security for Russian bases. Ultimately, though, with the fall of Assad, Russia's prestige in the Middle East may have taken an irreparable hit. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
2024 has been the hottest year on record. It's also marked the end of a major El Niño phase. There's a climate pattern that shifts back and forth between a warm phase and a cool phase, El Niño and La Niña. When there's a shift between the two, it brings about changes in ocean temperature, as well as wind and rainfall across the tropics. Chris Callahan is a climate scientist at Stanford University, and he told The World's Carolyn Beeler what the end of El Niño means for global weather.
So there are two major impacts that I see from the El Niño that just ended. The first is that there were a lot of local impacts in places like Latin America, where extreme rainfall brought landslides and other impacts similar to that, including increasing the potential for disease spread in places like Peru and so on. So many of the local impacts that we associate with El Niño in places like Latin America did manifest like they were generally predicted. Mm. The other major impact of El Niño over the past year was simply elevating global temperatures to significantly higher than they would have been otherwise. We're coming off two extremely warm years, with 2024 being the warmest year on record, as you said, and El Niño was a major contributor to the record warmth that we've seen, not only in local areas around El Niño conditions in the tropics, but globally as well.
So if you took El Niño out of the picture in 2024, is it possible to know if we still would have seen the record high temperatures that we did?
It's difficult to know. It definitely would have made it several tenths of a degree cooler, but the temperatures over the last several years, specifically 2023, were much warmer than we predicted based on the factors that we know to explain global temperature. So we're actually still sort of figuring out the conundrum of the very warm temperatures we've experienced over the last couple of years.
Mm. And what about all the climate-fueled natural disasters that we've seen in the past couple of years? Obviously, climate change is juicing all of these types of events. Did El Niño also help drive hurricane season and other events?
Yeah, it's a great question. The influence of El Niño differs based on where you are. So
sure.
Hurricane seasons in the Atlantic basin actually tend to be weakened by El Niño because of wind shear patterns in the other upper atmosphere. And so the hurricane seasons that we've seen in the Atlantic, at least, were as strong as they were, likely partly because of climate change, which sort of outpaced the potential weakening of those seasons from El Niño.
So the hurricane season was despite the El Niño effect.
Exactly correct. Yes. On the other hand, we've seen things like extreme rainfall in the western United States, major atmospheric rivers striking places that are vulnerable in states like California. And those are things that tend to be amplified by El Niño. So that is what we expected.
So as I understand it, we've been in kind of a neutral climate pattern since this summer when El Niño ended. And it looks like we may be transitioning into a La Niña period. Can you remind us what that is?
Yeah, so El Niño is the warm phase of this broader oscillation, which tends to be defined by very warm ocean temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. That was what characterized the Pacific Ocean in 2023 and early 2024. Over this summer, temperatures cooled off a little bit in the Pacific Ocean, and we're now transitioning to slightly cooler conditions that are currently called ENSO-neutral conditions. So this is, we're sort of not in either a La Niña or an El Niño. But we are forecast to move soon into a mild La Niña, meaning that temperatures will cool off even further and we'll have a sort of reversal of this oscillatory pattern in the Pacific.
And how long is a La Niña expected to last?
This one is expected to be relatively weak and relatively short, so it will definitely last through the next several months, but it's currently forecast to transition back to neutral states in the spring of next year, so maybe March or April.
What does this portend for natural disasters or extreme weather events?
So La Niña tends to have impacts that are not exactly opposite, but potentially sort of opposite to El Niño. So we should expect to see greater rainfall in the Western Pacific, meaning around Indonesia, the Philippines, parts of Australia, and so on, and potentially warmer ocean temperatures in that region as well. On the other hand, because this La Niña is forecast to be relatively mild, it might not bring such great impacts as we typically see from El Niño.
What about global temperature averages? What are you looking for in 2025?
And I think this is the really big open question in much of the climate community at present. Typically, what we'd expect is that La Niña will bring a slight weakening of global temperature trends and a slightly cooler year relative to 2024. On the other hand, the climate change signal is increasingly strong in global temperatures. And so if 2025 continues the record hot trends that we've seen, it's possible that we could be looking at a world in which the influence of climate change is outstripping the influence of La Niña, and we could get very, very hot conditions regardless of La Niña. However, that's just a question, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Chris Callahan is a climate scientist at Stanford University, speaking there with the world's Carolyn Beeler about what to expect as we head into a La Niña weather cycle in the coming year. Hindus worldwide are preparing for a religious festival early next year, and it's a big one. The Mahakumbh is a celebration of the planet Jupiter completing one revolution around the sun. This only happens about once every 12 years. To mark the occasion, the Hindu faithful travel to sites along the banks of sacred rivers in India to bathe in their waters. The ritual is believed to cleanse people of their past sins. The largest gathering will take place near the city of Prayagraj, where three of these rivers meet. The city is expecting a mind-boggling 400 million pilgrims. That's more than the entire population of the United States, by the way. The festival starts on January 13th and is expected to be the largest peaceful gathering in human history. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. When people in Nicaragua went out into the streets in 2018 to protest against the country's dictatorship, police and government loyalists responded with deadly force. After that, many people involved in those protests fled the country. And that's why a lot of Nicaraguan exiles are now living in neighboring Costa Rica. Among them are musicians, trying to build community and spread the word about the political turmoil back home. Jamie Fullerton headed to San Jose, Costa Rica's capital city, to meet one of them.
Guguita Acuna is playing a gig in the University District of San Jose, Costa Rica's capital city. The room is cluttered with beanbags and amateur poets. Acuna plays songs about family, feminism, and her country, Nicaragua.
How was the show?
So it's always very emotional because it's pretty much exposing yourself. It's getting naked in front of people, getting your soul naked in front of people, talking about a very painful process that you have to deal with.
The painful process here is Acuna's exile from Nicaragua, which borders Costa Rica to the north. In April 2018, concerns about social welfare changes sparked huge protests against the country's dictator, Daniel Ortega. Police and pro-government paramilitary groups killed hundreds of protesters, thousands were injured, and many more were harassed and monitored. After Acuna took part in protests, her family home was set on fire. Then she received death threat phone calls.
So at that point, I knew that I was getting my family in danger too, and I told my mom like this has happened, and she told me, well, I'd rather have you far from me than buried.
Like hundreds of thousands of other Nicaraguans, Acuna fled to Costa Rica. More than 6 years later, Ortega is still in power, following an election in 2021 denounced by many international observers as a sham. U.S. President Joe Biden said the election was neither free nor fair, while Ortega said people turned up to vote for peace. Meanwhile, Acuna is still in San Jose. Over that time, in San Jose, Acuna's music has become a rallying call of resistance, remorse, and hope for Nicaraguans torn from their homeland. Acuna is now in her early 30s. She was brought up in Managua, Nicaragua's capital city. Her family often played the music of Carlos and Luis Enrique Mejia Godoy, famous brothers who soundtracked the Sandinista revolution of the 1970s. Like Acuna, the Godoys are now living in exile after the Sandinistas' leader Daniel Ortega formed his own dictatorship, crushing dissent and free speech. After the protests and death threats in 2018, Acuna joined the thousands of Nicaraguans seeking refugee status in Costa Rica.
I left Nicaragua with a computer and my ukulele and some clothes. I look several ways. I start singing in the street. I have to sell popcorns. I have to ask for money in the street at some point.
In Nicaragua, music was just Acuna's hobby. But after a friend of a friend heard her singing in San Jose, she was offered a gig in a restaurant. She played Nicaragua Nicaraguita, an old song by the Mejia Godoy brothers.
And I cried in the middle of the song. And I kind of felt devastated because it was that point where you realize I'm probably not going to be coming back as soon as I expected. It was a wake-up call somehow.
Acuna played more gigs in San Jose, and fellow Nicaraguan exiles started turning up, waving flags and singing along. For the first time, Acuna started composing her own songs. They were personal and political.
La luna sube, escala 10 peldaños de nube.
At another San Jose show, I watch Acuna perform a song about her grandmother's death and not being able to attend the funeral due to her exile. Other songs are about the collective pain of Nicaraguans forced to flee their country.
The song starts saying, llora, mi pueblo llora, por tanta sangre que se derrama en represión. My people cries, and they cry for all the blood that is shed due to the repression.
Acuna is now part of a lively community of Nicaraguan exile musicians living in San Jose. I watch her play her third gig in 2 days on a bill with some of them. She says that beyond finding community, her music helps document the truth about what's happening back home. In San Jose, locals have told her that before they heard her singing about Nicaragua, they didn't realize that the political situation was still dire there.
It is a lot easier to get a song across the public than a political speech. The vibrations of music helps also people to resonate with the meaning and the struggle as well. Art helps us to become more empathetic people.
Last month, two-thirds of the National Assembly voted to change the Nicaraguan constitution, giving Ortega and his wife absolute power over the country. Sandinista Party Congressman Walmaro Gutierrez defended the vote.
Porque anteriormente, el pueblo de Nicaragua...
Before, Nicaraguans were urged to vote every 5 years and were told how to vote and almost who to vote for, Gutierrez said. Now, he claimed, Nicaraguans can choose to elect whoever they want. Given that Ortega keeps strengthening his grip on power, I ask Acuna if she has hope that she and her fellow exiles might one day return.
So I do have hope. I have hope because I see people. I see people that although they're struggling, although we are struggling, we are still fighting. We stand tall and we carry on.
En la ciudad, niños sueñan con el regresar.
For the world, I'm Jamie Fullerton in San Jose.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio here in Boston. Find us online at theworld.org and subscribe to our daily podcast so you never miss an update on the day's top global news and stories. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
Fértil vos y yo podemos ser. Y en la ciudad, las familias.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.